ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Welcome to another episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. This week we have Daily Maverick Managing Editor Janet Hurd. Here's what's coming your way. Budget cuts threaten to decimate our already fragile education sector. Later, express kidnappings are on the rise. We look at the stats.
Kidnappings generally over the last decade. I think the Institute of Security Studies reported a 260% increase over the last decade.
Then, a national hero. Why rape survivor Alison Buerta needs your help. And it's bye-bye car powership. But first, more than 100 days in, our government of national unity is teetering on the edge as various political parties struggle to meet each other halfway. From the highly controversial Basic Education Laws Amendment Bill to national health insurance, power-sharing role players just can't see eye to eye. So, can a newly formed Conflict Resolution Committee be the GNU's saving grace?
Janet, it's been way too long since our last chat. How have you been?
Very well, thanks, Lizanne. And you?
Great. I'm wonderful. Now, today's show is quite a mixed bag. I mean, we're going from politics to crime, and we even have a little bit of sports towards the end. But let's kick things off with what I believe to be one of the biggest political stories of last week, and I don't think a lot of people were necessarily aware of it, and that's the first sitting of the Conflict Resolution Committee, which is chaired by Deputy President Paul Mashatile. There wasn't a lot of coverage on this, but it's really a crucial step towards ironing out several policy differences within the GNU. So why was this committee set up in the first place?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree. This is one of the bigger issues. It really is a make or break for our government of national unity. You know, whether it can actually work or not depends on how it deals with conflict and disagreement. And let's be frank, there's a lot of contradictions really between the policies of different parties. So this mechanism, which is a kind of a clearinghouse, aims to resolve any dispute. It's chaired by Paul Mashatile. It's got people like Kenny Kunene from the PA, Bante Kholomisa, and also people like Brett Heron. So it's an interesting bunch of people. This will be the make or break sort of clearinghouse to try and battle issues. And the first one, obviously, would be the Bella Act on language, which really has been probably the most troublesome for the government of national unity, along with the NHI. And they are going to meet again this coming week to actually discuss this issue, among other issues.
And in terms of this so-called clearinghouse mechanism that they've kind of called it, how does President Cyril Ramaphosa hope to see this mechanism actually work or be put to use?
So they have been working on this mechanism for a while, and I think that's why it took a little while to get going. But there is going to be, like, for instance, there will be a technical committee which will also be established, and that will serve as like a processing channel for matters of divergence within the government of national unity. The political leaders that signed the statement of intent at the time of forming this government of national unity, this mechanism will establish this forum that will actually tackle issues around the statement of intent. So I think a lot of it will go back to looking, okay, so what was the statement of intent and how do we make sure that we can find common ground within the terms of reference and the statement of intent, which is actually what led to this formation in the first place. But it's about finding consensus. So that's really what the issue is about, finding consensus in the interest of the country.
You've mentioned the NHI and you've mentioned Bella. And firstly, the presidency seems largely optimistic that the GNU is in a good place. I mean, on Wednesday, presidency spokesperson Vincent Magwenya said, quote, "We are equally confident that notwithstanding disagreements that are yet to emerge, no member of the GNU is going to leave the GNU." So I want to know from you, do you see the power-sharing agreement surviving the NHI and Bella battles?
Lizanne, I think the one thing that we can see is, say, if we look at the Bella Act, for instance, I think Ramaphosa's willingness to, you know, he signed the bill but he left out two clauses with the acknowledgement that they are contentious. These are the two most contentious clauses, 4 and 5. He suspended that for a 3-month consultation period. So I think that is a sign. I don't think he would have done that had there not been a government of national unity. So I think already we are seeing the impact of what it is like to be in a government of national unity. And I really enjoyed the piece that Richard Poplack wrote in Daily Maverick a few weeks ago, that Cyril Ramaphosa is living his best life. He loves this kind of, he seems to thrive in this kind of consultative environment. So I think the potential is there, but a lot is at risk. We're not out of the woods with the government of national unity at all. I mean, it's early days. I don't think I could say completely confidently that there won't be ructions and that a fallout could happen. I think the Bella Act is the first one. And I do think if, for instance, they sign clauses 4 and 5, I don't see how, for instance, the Freedom Front will stay in a government of national unity. So I suppose it's going to go down to a compromise. Who and how and what are you prepared to compromise in the interests of keeping the government of national unity in place? And remember, this is a 5-year term. So it's early days. And I think we are going to see a lot of challenges. And it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out.
In September, Basic Education Minister Siviwe Gwahube told media that our education is under immense pressure. She further explained that these pressures have been years in the making as a result of aggressive budget cuts within the department, an economic downturn, and general mismanagement. As we head towards the midterm budget speech later this month, several provinces are begging government to intervene before schools pass the point of no return.
Let's focus our attention on education, and in particular the budget cuts that have led to several educators and NGOs urging government to address the country's worsening education crisis. There was an eye-opening article in Daily Maverick's print publication, DM168, not too long ago, highlighting the crippling impact of budget shortfalls, mostly on a provincial level. And it was really quite a stark view of what the implications of it could be for our children. So what's really behind this funding crisis that we are seeing?
We're heading now into the medium-term budget policy statement, which comes at the end of the month. So I think that's why this issue has reached a center stage. And there's a lot of lobbying and jostling going on for a bigger slice of the pie. So what led up to it is, it seems one of the most glaring things is that the number of people that have been attending state schools has increased by almost 300,000 in the past 5 years, while teacher numbers have remained virtually flat. So we're sitting here with an education system that is heaving. It's completely beyond capacity, and we just don't have enough teachers to support the growth in the schools. Apparently, the public wage negotiations also made a big shortfall in the budget because they've increased public sector salaries. So those are the two, I think, big factors in where we've reached now. The provinces have obviously been dealing with the budget shortfalls in different ways, with a spotlight on the Western Cape, which was going to reduce the number of teachers. They said they would do it by not renewing contract positions. But I think it's going to be a wait and see to see if Godangwana does actually shift at all or not, and how it's going to play out again on a provincial level. But I think our education system is buckling under capacity issues. And inequity, prevailing inequities. There's some schools that are very well resourced because of a governing body post, and then you've got the schools that aren't.
And you've said that teachers are already stretched to their absolute limit. And with this multi-billion rand shortfall, thousands of teachers are expected to lose their jobs by next year if they don't find a way to address this. I'm no alarmist by any means, but it does feel as though we are fast headed to what you could call a total collapse of basic education in this country.
I think a lot of pressure is put on the teachers and the people who are in the system really trying to battle to make it work. So obviously it's the no-fee schools that really bear the brunt of these stresses and strains, where we still have in some schools kids using pit latrines. It doesn't just cut into the education department, it cuts across responsibilities across other departments. So it shouldn't be seen in isolation that this is just an education issue. It's all the departments need to, it's about our future. So I think all the departments that have anything to do with education in this country should be getting together and seeing how they can reduce this capacity strain on schools.
I also want to turn our attention to a more positive aspect of this conversation, and that's the teachers once again, because I think we tend to just look at the negative and always say that teachers don't care. I think we need to encourage all teachers to really continue fighting for our children. You know, just this month, we saw some of our top educators receive their proverbial flowers, so to speak, at the National Teacher Awards. And I think it really serves as such an important reminder that despite so many factors working against them, we still have teachers and principals dedicated towards enriching young lives, which I think that's that fighting spirit that we need within this sector at the moment.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to see the stories that have emerged out of the National Teacher Awards. And some of the teachers just going against the odds to just really just focus on, it's a calling, it's a passion. They just do it out of love. You know, teachers work really, really hard. Do you think we have problems with some teaching? For sure, with where the interests of the kids are not taken as paramount. But I think overall, the teaching fraternity really do deserve a thumbs up and a shout out from South Africa. And those National Teacher Awards are so great in that regard to see, for instance, the principal at Paterson High in Nelson Mandela Bay, who won she's the top principal in the country. She came to the school as a maths and science teacher, and how she worked through the ranks and has really been doing great things for a school that is in an area that's beset by gang violence and other challenges, and is a no-fee school, and it's just become like at the top of its tree through her. And I do think we need to honour those teachers. I have a soft spot for teachers myself. My mum was a teacher her whole life and retired at the age of 69 finally, and I just saw the love that good teachers have for their pupils, and that makes all the difference to a pupil. And we should pay attention more and praise these teachers, the ones that are really doing a great job.
Just a few years ago, the idea of kidnapping for ransom was something mostly seen in action-packed Hollywood movies. But in the past year, there's been a dramatic increase in what's now commonly referred to as express kidnappings. The amounts up for grabs are relatively small, with criminals targeting anyone from students to small business owners. Literally, no one is safe.
Let's move on to Stellenbosch. And this past Sunday, the Carte Blanche crew spent a night on the streets of Stellenbosch, in particular the areas around the Stellenbosch University campus, where many students have a good time, you know, late nights, all of that. Now, our story came after several attacks on students, including kidnappings for ransom, that have led to the students now living in fear, really. And we've spoken of kidnappings on this show before, but it seems these so-called express kidnappings, which is just a terrifying term in itself, are now becoming part of our daily lives.
Yes, Suzanne, that was a very worrying report to Suzanne in on an area of, as you said, which it seems to be, you know, people having a good time and letting their hair down among young people in that area that are also impacted by this weird phenomenon that is just, it feels like it just popped out of nowhere, this word, express kidnapping. I mean, that seems crazy. And it comes against the backdrop, obviously, of a huge increase in kidnappings generally over the last decade. I think the Institute of Security Studies reported a 260% increase over the last decade overall. And that means that they're an average of over 50 a day in the country. So, I mean, it's insane. And the express kidnappings is a particularly, you know, it's not what you would normally think of, you know, with a ransom demand made to family and friends. It's basically bank security. It's when people go to the ATM. And then it's so easy. There's so many ways that people can access your banking app under threat of violence. And this is what these express kidnappings are. And I see that the National Financial Ombuds Scheme has actually sounded the alarm here too. An article by Nisa Moodley, my colleague, she reported how that this type of kidnapping referred to as express kidnapping is on the rise. So they've also taken note, the National Financial Ombuds Scheme, seeing this trend. And I think this is the scary thing. It could happen to you. And how is the country going to, and how's the industry, how are we tackling this phenomenon to keep people safe? I see you can even get insurance called duress insurance. So the industry is taking note and there is, it's showing you the trend. We are sitting in a situation where it's becoming far too commonplace.
Now, if you want to know more about this harrowing crime trend, I strongly suggest our listeners read a piece titled Africa's Abduction Capital, Harrowing Tales of Kidnapping Syndicates Holding SA to Ransom. It's available on Daily Maverick's website. It was written in September by Vincent Kreiwagen and Nonkululeko Njilo, who we've also had on the show many times. And it's just a chilling bit of reading, but it also gives you insight into how anyone is a target these days for these express kidnappings. And it's really becoming a truly frightening trend that's beginning to take hold across the country.
She refused to be a victim when she bravely fought for her life back in 1994. Ever since her brutal attack, Alison Buerta has become the epitome of perseverance, hope, and healing. But now, 30 years after overcoming the odds, Alison once again finds herself in a fight for survival, and she needs our help.
I want to take us back to 1994, and this was a story that I think many of us know, and that's the horrific case of Alison Buerta, who was brutally raped and left for dead by Frans de Tooy and Teuns Krier. Granted, I was barely in primary school at the time, but I remember seeing her on front pages and hearing her name in the news extensively at the time. Everyone was talking about it. What do you recall of that time, Janet, when this story broke?
Right, Lizanne, that really was one of the most, I mean, if you think it was December 18, 1994, it's just months after the advent of the new South Africa. I recall it very well. There was such a feeling of, it was such an exciting year. It was such a wonderful year to see this country really make the transition into democracy. So that's the year in which it happened, at the end of that year. And the story played out over time, because of course, you know, Alison Buerta over the years became the sort of the brave face of a survivor of the most traumatic rape, the most awful. I mean, every rape is awful and traumatic. But the fact that she had the strength to tell her story and come out and put a face and a name to her experience was what was very, very unusual back then. It didn't happen. Very rarely were survivors prepared to speak out and come forward and actually say, listen, this is what happened to me. And that's what she did. And that's why that story, Alison, we will always be indebted to her for that courage that she showed. After being abducted in Port Elizabeth, she was in the car, a man with a knife just attacked her, literally. And then by the end of the night, she had been raped, stabbed, disemboweled. And I think her throat was slit 16 times. They thought she was dead, her attackers, but she survived. And she was 27 years old. And she ended up writing a book. She collaborated with a colleague, Marianne Tam. And her story is just incredible.
The reason I bring up her story is because, again, unfortunately, she finds herself fighting for her life once more. And this time as a result of an aneurysm. She was hospitalized late in September and she's undergoing medical procedures at the moment. And as per your colleague Marianne Tam's recent Daily Maverick article, Alison is in desperate need of financial support. And I mean, we don't normally do this on this show, but I really felt that because of the role Alison has played in really opening up the conversation around gender-based violence and really removing a lot of the stigma around speaking out about your experiences, I really felt that this is something we need to bring to everyone's attention. So tell us a bit more about how listeners can support Alison on this very long and difficult road that's ahead of her.
So through her attorneys, they've opened up a trust to actually help her pay her medical bills. She doesn't have finances, and this trust has been made available. There's a story that Marianne has written on our website where it explains how you can actually help her to make donations through this trust that the Tanya Kuhn attorneys have launched for her, and her family and friends have launched it. And the details are on the website for people if they feel strongly to make a donation. And it is, as you said, quite a rare thing to do to actually take this. But I do think that after a lifetime of what she's been through with her two killers out on parole, you know, they were put behind bars for life. The judge, in sentencing the two, he said both men should be removed from society for the rest of their lives. Well, they were paroled in July last year.
So our listeners can refer to the links in today's episode for more information on how you can help. And really, we hope and pray for Alison's recovery and for her loved ones to just have strength during this period, because it's really such an awful time.
It was presented as the ultimate solution to our load shedding woes. Car Powership became the absolute darling in government's efforts to keep the lights on. But the deal would have cost taxpayers at least 218 billion rands, and several questions were raised around how exactly this controversial deal with a Turkish powerships provider even came into existence. But if government is to be believed, the car powership deal has officially sunk.
Let's move our attention to some good news. And I want to quickly chat about the dreaded car powership. It's become quite a swear word around South African braais in recent years after government presented this ridiculous car powership deal as the ultimate solution to our energy crisis. The idea is now dead in the water, as our electricity minister put it, and he confirmed that it is, quote, behind us. And I just feel this is such a major win for taxpayers. It reminds me of the whole e-tolls thing, that with enough pressure, government eventually says, okay, we'll back off. So this is such a major win for us.
Yeah, I think I think we've learned to be a little bit skeptical about hearing something is dead, but sometimes things can somehow re-emerge in some other way. But I do think we need to take it on at face value when both the minister and then Dion George also saying that his latest quote was, for all intents and purposes, car powership is dead. So he's confirming Ramaphosa's earlier responses that it is dead in the water. So we can hope that that is the case. I do think that there are quite a few lingering questions. We need to still look at how it actually got to the level that it did in terms of being motivated. Gwede Mantashe, he actually made the announcement that these Turkish car powership would provide power generation capacity to South Africa over 20 years, and he made that in February 2020, and there's been a fight since then. So the deal, we don't really have all the answers as to why this project was pushed ahead. So there are questions that still need to be answered. But I do think for now we can say that it has been clunk. And let's face it, we need to pay tribute to the campaigning and the activism of civic organizations in actually bringing to light the implications of such a weird power generation capacity. Even though we desperately need power, not at all costs.
Now, before we wrap up today's show, we can't not talk about the Proteas women cricket team. They've done amazing things at the ICC Women T20 World Cup, and they came face to face with some really strong competition, and they've proved really that women's sports in South Africa is the best it's ever been, and really that women's sports in South Africa deserves all the support and hype that often I feel is reserved for male sports a lot of the time. So this just made me so happy, and just once once again, you know, we've had Banyana Banyana, and now we have our Proteas woman, and they're just really proving that they are the best, and we should all keep an eye on women's sports in this country.
Absolutely, Lizanne. I think that the way they beat Australia, which we know was the first time, it's been incredible to watch, and I'm not a big cricket fan, I have to confess, but I love it when we reach such a level, and then I get excited, and I think it was just fantastic to see them close in on Australia in particular to make it into the final, and that in itself was such a victory. So I think that I'm certainly going to take more notice, and I think that that's exactly what this kind of thing does. It makes everyone take more notice, and even if you're not a cricket lover, there's going to be no ways that people aren't going to be taking notice of the Proteas woman.
Definitely.
Now and down in future. So yeah, it's a fantastic situation that has played out in Dubai.
Now, it's really been a jam-packed show today, Janet, and we've covered so many different things. And yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us. It's been fantastic as always, and I really wish you a happy and healthy and safe week.
Thanks so much, Lizanne.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.